Oh God. Oh my God.
I got to like an area where it's like, okay, there's like six people at a like reception desk and none of them are Nathan. And one of them's going to notice that I'm in Carhartt's and I'm filthy. So then I like bailed.
You made it.
But
that far,
yeah, though. I tried to like go and say hey to Nathan. Hey, Nathan.
Patreon supporter, Nathan. Yeah. Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, support us on Patreon. I'll make work visits. I might not get past the initial security check, but I'll try.
It's worth a shot.
Yeah.
I hear that at your work, you get Milanos.
I do.
I know. Fancy fucking bitch ass. Yeah, like you get Milanos.
King size bed. It's great.
I know. Look at you. You've really come up.
The only extra research I've done on this is watch the Rugrats episode.
Did you?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. I can't wait.
Fuck
to hear.
Yeah. Good.
I'm so glad you did that.
Because I know we danced around that the first time. Mm. The sad lost episode.
So yes, we're officially podcasters now. We lost an episode. We have to re-record something.
Doing things over again. This time it's going to be weirder.
Yeah.
I'm sensing we have. Yeah, we're bringing in some rich secondary texts into this episode. Rugrats episode. Mm-hmm. I did some deep dives into YouTube comments on clips from the Kiss of Death.
Please dive deep.
I just rewatched both movies today, but I have some new thoughts on Kiss of Death, having just got done with it half an hour ago.
Hmm. New thoughts being it wins.
Sure.
Well, here's okay, good. Here's a question I have. You guys are in season two still?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Technically, so this is now officially our last episode of the round of 32. So we're heading into the Slicksteen. Then the Master 8.
Okay.
And Final Foreskin.
Okay. Because I was going to say
we're adults.
I mean, one of us has multiple children, so that's technically true. We're adults.
Yeah. Kinda.
Kinda.
I just left my kids at home.
Well, that's you have an older one now that can watch the younger
that's
one.
That's true. Yeah, she's almost three.
Yeah.
That's why you have first children. So you can have a babysitter when you have a better child.
Correct.
Yeah.
Cora doesn't listen to this, right?
Not yet.
Well, we should probably get this out of the way. Welcome back to Cage Match, a roundabout way of meeting Nicolas Cage. I'm your host, Sean, here with my co-host.
Nick, I'm Nick.
Well done.
And our producer.
Peter, hello.
And we have back for the third time, though you're only hearing them for the second time, our guests.
Gary on the air.
And Roxanne.
Yeah. Lovely to have you back.
Our
sorry
guests
that we
who
lost
are better at our job than us.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet their laptops didn't get stolen.
We make them share a mic to try and bring them down to our level.
But yeah, welcome back. Thank you for tolerating the fact that that entire episode, which was actually pretty fucking funny, got lost.
I'm bummed about that.
Yeah, me too.
Nah,
too bad
sucked.
This one's going to be a death march.
Yeah. I'm tired.
Yeah, me too.
I took a nap.
Lucky.
And then I pre-drank because it felt like the episode. I was just going to bring like bottles of liquor and just have bottles on the table.
I would have made a good Patreon picture, but thank you for not.
I mean, there's a few things left in the bar.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I might get housed.
We'll see. We'll see what happens later in this episode if we really want to bust into the brown liquors.
Peter will have a real hard time editing continuity into this. He has to just leave it.
We can only drink liquor if we're able to take shots from between your titties, Nick.
That's fair.
That seems reasonable, actually.
I am the most Elizabeth Shue built human here.
Totally.
Maybe only on the top like quarter part of my body, but
still counts. That's the important part.
She's got one of those big old noggins like me.
So in this
big
show,
noggin, little boobs.
We take 64 Nicolas Cage movies, bracket them out, and figure out what the most cagiest film is as decided by Nick and me. This week, it is The Return of Kiss of Death and Leaving Las Vegas.
You make it sound like a sequel to Kiss of Death.
Definitely.
Yes.
All right. I'm just sad we don't get more. What's his fucking name? Ronnie?
Oh, fucking Rappaport?
Yeah. Oh, God. I was trying to remember his name the other day, and I was on the stairs talking to Rappaport? Josie, and we're like, you know, and Kiss of Death, it's got that guy, you know, the guy, he's, hey, Ma!
Yeah, Grandma.
Ma, it's that fucking cat again!
I was thinking about this, and I was like...
She knew.
Half asleep, sort of, you know, in between baby
life and
being,
death.
Yeah, pretty much. And I was thinking about Michael Rapaport, and I was like, you know, if you look like that dude, you never get a shot to be like the leading man or the handsome romantic comedy guy. Like, you are always either going to be like the friendly weird neighbor or a shitbag. That's it.
He had a sitcom for a minute.
Was he a shitbag? Or was he the friendly neighbor?
He was the he was the main guy. He was the dad.
Was he a bad dad?
He was a neighbor to someone.
Yeah. I mean, he was a shitty dad, but he was a dad.
You thank you. Case in point.
Have you ever wondered what a spinoff of Home Improvement would have been like from Wilson's point of view?
My aunt knows that dude. I mean, he's dead now, but she sang in the choir with him.
Did you ever see his face?
That actually kind of brought me down. Why'd you have to?
Sorry. Take it back.
I can't.
I want to know what the rest of that bit was.
There was no bit. I just kind of wanted to know. This is one of my off the cuff questions. It's what I'm famous for.
Yeah. He was into skin flicks.
Oh, fuck yeah. Okay. Now I'm engaged. So they were in choir together and he whacked off a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Your kind of guy.
He is my kind of guy.
I don't know how to get some of those.
Yeah. Sometimes I just dig a hole.
Since we're sort of dancing around the fact that we've done this before, I think we can just go with Kiss of Death to start. I know, Rox, you've got something definitely that I want to hear about this.
What the what?
Well, I can lead with a couple of comments from YouTube.
So is the whole, I just want to know, is the whole movie on YouTube?
So yes, it is. And that's how Rob and I watched this movie.
As it was intended.
Yes. Like, you can't stream it. It's only available on DVD or through this one YouTube upload.
I have a Spanish import Blu-ray of it. So yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
We didn't go down that path. Yeah. We went down the path
of El Beso of Death.
But yeah, the one that you can watch on YouTube. PSA for anyone else who is thinking of watching this movie. You can watch
Anybody's
it on YouTube.
Anybody's going to get it right. It should have been you.
Yeah, no, you fucked it up.
But the
I don't speak Spanish. I just have melanin. You don't just know Spanish because you have melanin. Racist.
Sorry.
sorry. No. Yeah, sorry. And also sorry.
One of these
this is my fate. It's my fate to get trod upon because I too am a Rapaport. I don't know if you guys know this, but it's true.
Do I need to quack that out?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
I do. I actually have an uncle named Michael Rapaport.
Is it him?
No.
Oh, damn it.
Because you got to tell us if it is.
Yeah, no.
Those are the rules.
Podcast law.
I didn't bury the lead. It's not him. Okay. But okay, so on YouTube, you can watch Kiss of Death. However, it was like a recording that somebody made of their TV screen. So the whole thing is flipped. It's backwards.
Incredible.
And it's very blurry to the point that literally it wasn't until today when I watched some like other shorter YouTube videos of just clips from the movie, I only then realized that the movie was set in the 1990s and not in the 1940s, which I thought it was based on the aesthetic of how it looks when it's really blurry and backwards.
I want to watch this version.
It was a CRT. You know,
I've been watching it clean. I fucked up.
I mean, you can give it a shot. To be honest, I don't think Rob and I made it through the whole thing. We watched most of it and then read the Wikipedia summary because it was hard to handle. But
I watched it before. Okay. So yeah, you did your homework the first time.
Yeah. Anyway,
Gary always goes to completion.
That's true.
Okay.
you can tell us more about that later, Nick. Okay. So, well, here's a good place to start. PS5 and stuff here made the comment, never heard of it, but looks good. A response from Planet Hellgate 1278. One of the most hardcore movies I ever saw. I fucking love this movie. I wanted to be like Nicolas Cage after this movie.
To be fair, I would like to bench press Hope Davis as well.
Yeah.
40 times.
40 times.
That's while your dad watches.
Want dad to watch.
Another quick one here at Carl Nemetsky says, excellent movie, 5 stars. One of the greatest twists in movie history. Nothing is what it seems. And I love how the trailer doesn't show you the twist.
Are these plants?
What was the twist?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
That was exactly the question I asked myself.
I can't think of a single twist in this entire fucking movie.
Seems like a great lead into
it's a flat straight line. It seems like.
Yeah, okay, so I'm the only one who hasn't rewatched this recently. So, surprisingly,
sum it up for us.
Okay. From memory, I think, what was this? Like almost 6 months ago that we watched this?
It's been
this?
A while. Close to that, yeah.
So about 6 months ago. So there's a ginger guy and he is living the straight life after prison. He gets wrapped up in like some bullshit when Michael Rapaport comes by his place and he's like, hey man, you gotta like drive for me tonight. Just tonight. Like I'm your boy. I've always been there. Oh, like his parents took care of the ginger when he was a lonely child. So he's like, fine, I'll do it. But I got a baby, so it's got to be cool. And Rappaport's like, it's cool. So they do this thing and he like has to drive a truck full of stolen cars from A to B. But they do it the dumb way. And then the cops catch on. And so the cops pull him over and a drunk guy in the cab shoots Samuel L. Jackson. And so the ginger gets blamed and he goes, okay, here we go. He goes on the lam. This is now I'm getting sketchy on it. hold on. No, wait, let me think about this one more time.
Yeah. Circle back. BAD.
Oh yeah. Oh, he gets pulled in because now he has to be like a mole for the shit cops. So he goes undercover into this whole crime ring that includes Nicolas Cage in cool, like, cutaway shirts. And, oh, he's got a goatee, which is this his only goatee? How many goatees have we had Nicolas Cage wear?
Didn't he have a goatee with a Sympathy for the Devil?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But, like, those are, that's few decades and far apart. Few yeah, and far that's between. Nice. It's a, honestly a pretty decent look for him. It really changes his face. So ginger guy gets in decent with Nicolas Cage and
Nicolas Cage has asthma.
Oh yeah. And he's got a cool bedazzled inhaler that says BAD, which stands for balls, attitude and direction. I know that.
yeah, that's for life now.
Yeah, we struggled over it so much in the last 6 months, constantly trying to remind ourselves what it stood for. So yeah, he's got an inhaler and they become chums and they're doing, I don't know, heckles and stuff together. And then Ginger, oh, he did some time, didn't he?
He did do some
yeah,
time.
Yeah, okay, so like when he got picked up earlier, he did some time and then his wife was like working for Michael Rapaport, and Michael Rapaport was a real scumbag and he tried to sleep with her. He did sleep with her. Yeah. It's blurry, it's, much yeah. like her night that night.
This is going to be heavily edited at this point.
Can you just speed it up really
yeah.
fast?
Yeah, just chipmunk at three times speed. That's fine.
And then Rapaport died. Yeah.
So when Ginger gets out, he manufactures the circumstances that gets Rapaport killed.
He gets beat to death.
Ah, nice. Oh, yeah. He does, by Nicolas Cage in a poncho.
Yes.
That was good. Okay. I remember that.
Never walk into an office where everyone's wearing ponchos and they're laying out plastic.
Yeah.
Just turn around.
Also, Ving Rhames is in this and dies.
Oh, yeah. Ving Rhames.
He doesn't like red.
Oh, yeah. That's so cool. I liked that a lot. He wouldn't take the Land Rover.
It's a bad color.
Every character in this movie has like a shtick to the point where it's just like they're caricatures. Sam Jackson has the leaky eye. Ving Rhames doesn't like the color red.
That's the twist, though. Okay, Ving Rhames is the twist because he was a Fed.
He was a Fed.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Thanks. And then Cuck Lover 2817.
And then Nick Cage has too many things. You're allowed one thing, but Nick Cage has asthma and doesn't like
metal, the taste of metal in his mouth. Yeah. No. So he couldn't get plastic forks in jail. He had to use metal forks because somebody had tipped him off.
Also, Stanley Tucci is in this.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
This like,
more Tucci. That's
the
good.
The cast of this film
he's what, like a DA or some shit?
Yeah.
Like a dirty DA trying to angle for mayor or some shit?
Classic DDA.
Caruso. What's his name?
David.
The ginger.
Caruso.
Yeah. Yeah.
What more do you want from me? It's David Caruso.
David Caruso. No, I thought that was his character name from whatever cop show he's on forever.
Yeah,
no, CSI. NYPD Blue.
NYPD Blue.
We talked about this last time. And
I don't know who David Caruso is.
I mentioned the cultural phenomenon that it was when he got out of bed naked.
Right,
that was
a huge moment. I remember this.
Yeah, yeah. And doing research after the fact, because I just spitballed it at the time, the first time we were on the show. But yes, in fact, it was a moment. And we were musing about his career and how like tepid it seemed. Another thing that I recall from the last time we were on is we were talking about Nicolas Cage as villain. Why you think he hasn't played more villains in his career? Because I didn't think this film was all that great or entertaining.
No, it's not.
However, you know, he does his damn thing and he makes the villain character interesting, and you do want to watch him be a villain. At least I wanted to continue to watch him do villainous things.
He doesn't do a lot of villain roles. He's changing that a bit more in his later career, because Sympathy for the Devil, he plays a great psychopath.
And it looks like Long Legs, he has a very disturbing role in.
Yeah, he's a serial killer in that.
Yeah, so that's kind of villainous.
Yeah.
He gets involved in villainy.
Kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know if Dexter was a killer.
Mild villainy.
What?
It's like one of the worst kinds.
Hey, man, I haven't seen it yet. I'm not going to prejudge.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't know what's in it.
I think
he just
dips his toe in a little bit of evil, and maybe he gets out clean.
It's a redemption story.
Yeah.
Long
he probably had a dad who died of an asthma attack.
I think they're gaslighting us. I think this is actually a romantic comedy, and I'm going to go into it with that vibe. With lotions and stuff.
Nick Cage doesn't do a lot of like heels, and so it's always interesting to see him. Little Junior Brown is just such an odd character.
He's like, just got the most character, I feel like, in the story, and I think
that's fair.
Initially could have attracted Nicolas Cage, because he does look for interesting characters.
And this is also his biggest, I think, he's ever been in a film.
He's pretty fucking jacked.
In swoleness,
yeah. I mean, Con Air, he was pretty ripped, too.
This was, when was this? When did this movie come out?
95.
When did Con Air come out?
97.
So that was kind of his swole era. Yeah.
Wait, that's wild to me, actually, that this came out in 95, because didn't Leaving Las Vegas come out in 94?
Yeah, I think we talked about that these movies, like,
they were very close,
after each one.
And
right
his body is totally different in the two movies.
Entirely, yeah. It's like from schlub to...
How old is he at this point?
Rectangle.
And I think Kiss of Death was probably recorded earlier, just languished for a while, because it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
I've really turned around on this film, because I really remembered enjoying it more like the first couple times we watched it, because I'm like, this is weird. Caruso's bad, but it's got a bunch of good people in it, and Nick Cage is weird. And I rewatched it today, and I'm like, nobody cares. Nobody's trying. Nick Cage isn't even really trying.
Hold on. What's the name of the strip club? This is important.
Baby Cakes.
Oh, fuck yeah, Baby Cakes. All right, I'm back on. This movie's awesome.
That place is so well lit.
Yeah.
Totally. They've got some cool metallic plants.
And rotating mirrors. But I don't want to see other like sleaze bags.
No.
I don't want to be able to look other perverts in the eye.
That's been my problem with like Washington strip clubs, and why I've never gone is like, without the filter of alcohol, it's just a bunch of sober dudes skeezing on chicks like 20 years their junior. Yeah,
it's pretty gross.
It's hella gross. It's like, you need alcohol to lubricate the situation and make it social and not just like dudes remembering things. I think maybe is that the weird part? Like, you're going to remember it all. My friends went to it, like, we were in Portland recently and people wanted to go to a strip club, and we're like, oh, okay. And it's like the first night, and we're like, just like, some of us just dropped our shit off and like had two drinks, and it's like strip club time. And we're like walking, I'm like sitting there, I'm like, hold on, something's not right. The sun is still up. It's like 8:30 in the evening. This is the wrong time to hit a strip club. I don't care that it's Friday. I mean, like, at least maybe you're getting the B-minus squad then, but...
Yeah, a friend of ours also was talking about how strip clubs in Portland are full nude. And he was like, you know what's really weird? When you just see someone's butthole. I don't know that I need that.
Unless you grow up seeing buttholes. And then it's weird to go to somewhere where you're like, wait, why can't I see your butthole? Washington. I have to be sober and I can't even look at a butthole.
Oh,
yeah. Rude.
Virginia, the fucking Commonwealth, their strip club laws, no nipple.
Yeah, Missouri was like that too.
Huh.
It's like, so what's
the point?
The point.
You know what you could see? You know what you could see nipple? A fucking like life drawing event.
True enough.
Yeah.
Does that rule cross genders, like at a male strip club?
Review. We call them reviews.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm not there to critique or anything. I'm just
that's a good point.
I'm not there for that.
Pasties? Yeah. Are there male pasties? I mean, I assume they're similar.
That's
pasties,
fucking hilarious too. Like,
I hope so. Like, otherwise, that's unfair.
What would? Okay. One quick survey and then back to the movie. Mm-hmm. What would be your pasty choice for money
besides Nick Cage's face?
That's a pretty good choice.
Pretty good one. Yeah. See, that's an option.
Which
you may have won this.
Okay. No more thinking. Okay. Well, you go first then, Rox.
One would say B A and the other one would say D.
Nice.
All right.
My would be little tiny trash can lids with Oscar the Grouch's face on them.
Oh, that's good. Mine would just be my face going.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fair.
Mine would be photos of my nipples.
Smart.
Loophole.
Yeah, totally got them.
Mine gets complicated and
go on. Good.
So I'd probably like, you know, the like flour, the seltzer flour that clowns would have in their pocket. So I'd get like seltzer flowers. I'd probably start taking a lot of estrogen like beforehand, like for months beforehand. And then I'd force myself to lactate and I would do a show where like, maybe I'm dressed like a clown.
And does your milk come out of the seltzer flowers or is it still
seltzer?
Yeah,
that's the thing. So I'll be dancing. I'll be getting up there on the ladies. And then it's like, I don't know. Do they pull my finger or. Here's what it is. Yeah, you honk my nose, which is obviously on my G string, and then I just milk on your face.
Well, I think we've covered this movie well enough. No, I'm kidding.
Bye, Sean. So we are taking applications for a new host. We lost one tonight.
I was a life drawing model for a spell in college. I answered a flyer that I found on a telephone pole in College Town. That was the number you called was the number of Bill the Magician. I called that number.
What did the flyer say that was so enticing?
Money.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Okay. This is important only because I had several life drawing models that I've experienced in my life, and they all had like a staff that they held.
Yeah, the staff.
Did you have a staff?
No. Now I feel like I need to go back there and ask why.
Every Dimitri that I ever drew had a staff.
How many Dimitris have you drawn?
Not any props.
A couple.
I think we've had this conversation. Yeah, no, they have the staff. What for leaning?
Yeah, and like it gets a good angle.
Yeah.
For the dangle.
Yeah.
Kiss of Death. What do you guys think?
It's a made-for-TV movie that somehow got real stars in it.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. Like, I don't know who thought Caruso could be a Hollywood leading man, but they were wrong, and I hope they lost their job.
Yeah, this definitely hits that, like, weekend, early afternoon syndicated TV. It's not great. It's not terrible, though. I don't think it's, like, the worst. I don't remember thinking to myself, this movie never should have been made, because it's got Michael Rapaport, and anytime I see him, that's an open invitation to imitate his voice, and that's worth something to me.
You mean your voice?
Yes. It's worth it for me to use my voice in a manner that makes fun of somebody else.
I don't disagree with Lovey 1980 that the 1990s had some of the best innovative and risky films that Hollywood has ever produced. But I do not agree that this was one of them.
Shout out Lovey 1980.
Yeah, it was very mediocre the whole time.
Yeah, didn't love it, but really did enjoy watching Cage do villain things and would watch him play all sorts of different villains. I'm excited to see what he comes up with in these new ventures that it sounds like he's working on. And I am a little bemused about the fact that he hasn't done more of this, because it was great. He was hilarious. He was also convincing, like his inner turmoil and rage about being like little, you know, like little junior, not living up to dad and like all that shit. Very believable. Also, yeah, you could sense his villainy. It worked. But yeah, the film didn't.
I do like watching him like jump up and down crying while shadowboxing like plant.
Oh yeah.
My dad died.
And then when he does first show up and he yeets the drunk guy.
Yeah, out I was of the gonna cab. Say the way he just fucking tossed him like bodily above him was pretty rad. I would let Nicolas Cage toss me like that. That'd be cool.
Okay, so on the matrix of this whole thing, good movie, good Cage, bad movie, bad Cage. Just real power run this.
Bad movie, not great Cage.
Certainly a bad movie. It's an boy, having not watched it in 6 months, a great movie, great Cage.
Never a bad Cage.
Bad movie, good Cage.
Yeah, I agree. He was for sure the highlight.
Yep, I'm with that too.
Yeah,
I think it's a fun performance. He's weird enough and Cage enough in it that it feels kind of special in like that early time of his career too. But yeah, the movie sucks. It's bad.
Maybe it's just
Sexy Tucci though.
Yeah. It might just be the dialogue for me. Just that like he's given nothing great to say.
Yeah,
it's true.
The campiness of it at this point has just worn off. And she's like, this is just bad.
Yeah. B-A-D.
Yeah.
Balls, attitude, direction.
That's what this movie's got.
Now moving in a new direction.
Oh, wait.
Okay.
Wait, we all had our own fucking ones.
Oh, yeah. What we were
did.
We?
I can't remember, and I'm not going
to
come
I was
come
trying
up
to think
now.
Of mine earlier, because I was like, I think I had a really good one.
It was good.
They were good. They were all good.
They were all good. Yeah. Fuck. Gone forever.
Yep.
Okay, I've got one right now.
Do it.
Dick. D-I-K. Dignified, intelligent koala.
Nice.
Banger. All right, moving on. Yep.
You need a koala tat now, I think.
With a huge old hog. Otherwise, people won't get the reference.
Right.
It's true.
Right.
Gotta spell it out.
Why does that cuddly looking bear have a giant, veiny, aggressive human dick? Yeah. Because Santa's a lie.
Leaving Las Vegas.
Leaving this conversation.
Still a really good movie.
Boy, I can't tell you how excited I was to have psyched myself up all week to watch a super depressing movie when I was already tired last night. It was choice. It's a really hard movie to get yourself excited to watch.
It's not a fun movie.
No, it's a terrific movie, but yeah. It is not like something you look forward to all week. Like, I'm not sitting here like, oh man, I wish I could watch Kids tonight or Brick. That sounds like fun.
So if someone asked you, they're wanting to watch it for the first time, what would you recommend? How do they set themselves up for success?
Early morning stiff drinks.
Yeah,
so total immersion.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty good advice. It's that like bottle of vodka with a kiss of orange juice.
Yeah. Don't put it off. Just go for it. If you know the premise of the film, Nick Cage is going to drink himself to death and he's given himself 4 weeks.
Just the amount of money he has to get through each and every day in Vegas is just, he's like, I can do like 240, maybe 300 a day.
In the 90s.
Inflation.
Gary read the novel, and how much did you say he got as a severance? It was like something like $5,000 or something.
After we lost the last episode, Gary went and actually got the book and has read it. And we've gotten some readings sent to us through the process. And really, I want to kind of talk about the nature of adaptation.
Mm. Yeah. We're not talking about adaptation again.
Ever again.
We cut that.
I meant adaptation from book to screen.
I know.
But we're talking about adaptation again. The movie's great.
It is great. I love that movie.
Well, I think it's a great topic because Mike Figgis, the director, made some really bold choices with his adaptation of this story. And I actually watched an interview, the only one I could find on YouTube from the 90s, some very like traditionally looking like Midwestern Pentecostal lady with like a round haircut is interviewing him. And that's the only one I could find. And, you know, he doesn't mention John O'Brien once in his interview, which I thought was really fascinating. And when you watch the opening credits too, the first in the, they're not directly in this order. It's not like the first one is based on the book by John O'Brien, but it says based on Leaving Las Vegas by John O'Brien. And then the next thing that you see is screenplay by Mike Figgis, which is in a way truth telling, because I do think that his screenplay kind of usurps the story in some ways that I find a little unnerving, and I didn't necessarily agree with his choices, but then in ways that I do think really landed, because it's a great film, you know, so it's hard to argue with what he's created as a director. But having read the novel, it falls into that classic trope of, oh boy, the book is just so much better.
How is it just as a read? Does it read well? I mean, because John O'Brien didn't have a lot of work under his belt.
It looks about as thick as a Goosebumps book.
Yeah, so it's
so if that's your general scale on like how much reading you can handle,
it's an absolute joy to read. It reads super quickly. So some interesting notes in the book. You start, so it has an ABC format. Part A is Sarah's backstory. Part B is Ben's, and then they meet on page 124, and the book is only 189 pages long, whereas in the film, they meet in the first 20 minutes. You get kind of Ben's fall from grace. He's in Vegas, then he almost runs Sarah over in the middle of the street. So huge choice. Another huge choice is in the book, Sarah is gang raped in the first like 10 pages, and that experience kind of casts a shadow over her whole experience of the story, whereas Figgis tucks it at the very, very end of the entire film. So I'm curious to hear you guys talk about that. But let me first just give you a little bit of the prose. This is Ben and Sarah sitting over dinner after they've just met, talking effortlessly at the restaurant. They continue to pursue the tangential conversations that go with new acquaintance. This acquaintance, however, is maturing faster than most. Both of them feel an unspoken urgency to their friendship. Beyond the more obvious time factor that Ben feels, this impatience is due to an even more immediate need that they share. A vacuum, long unaddressed in Sarah and always fundamental in Ben, is being looked at and considered. They are recognizing an opportunity to prevent an emotional tragedy. They are struggling with the bewilderment of finding that a long-held assumption may not be so. They are at once seeing for the first time decisions that they have made and unexpected options that they may now have. To Ben, these feelings are apart from what he is doing to himself. The short term that he has assigned to his own life is having its effect on his mentality beyond his day-to-day conduct change. He believes that dying soon, is an unalterable fact of his life, and it's become more deeply rooted in his reality. He thinks of it no more than anyone else thinks of their own natural death. He's aware of it, but not obsessed with it. Subtly, though, his actions have taken on added significance to him. The governors have all been removed, and he now looks for the direct and deliberate, embracing the aggressive and shunning the abusive. With the specter of the finite looming very near, Ben can almost envisage this time as a microcosm of his whole life, a narrow but tall area to be played very intensely. So a girl is a girlfriend, and a girlfriend is everything. It's the psychology of a 14-year-old who is also disinterested in the not-so-foreseeable future. Ben adores Sarah, would like her to be a part of his life. But changing his life, extending it, is no longer an option that would occur to him. She should accept that context in the same way that he has. Though it may be wishful, he sees in her the capacity to do this, and it is what he considers to be her charm.
No metaphor in that. It's just very clinical, like he feels this way.
I was gonna say it almost reads like the directions for these actors.
That's what I'm talking about. It seems like the thesis for this entire concept, you know. It's like, oh, okay, you read that and it's like, that's a movie.
Yeah.
Like, I got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That
let's put the other shit somewhere else.
Yeah.
That sentence or line about the absence of like being looked at and being seen. It's like, oh wow, that's so like, I'm sure true amongst people in the sex industry, prostitutes and strippers alike, where they're looked at, but they're not like seen and considered.
Mm-hmm. One of the readings I sent y'all, if you recall, several months ago, was the scene that Mike Figgis puts at the beginning of the film where Ben goes to the strip club. Mm-hmm. And in the film, he just absolutely destroys a bottle of hard alcohol and the music's really loud. And there's like this old looking pervert sitting next to him. But in the book, it's this really deep reflection on this very question that you're bringing up, Nick. And John O'Brien writes it that what Ben is interested in is watching a sex worker turn herself on and the relationship between her and her reflection in the mirror, knowing that like she's not getting turned on by any of the weirdos that are staring at her. What she's getting turned on by is her relationship with herself, and she's doing her work. Mm-hmm. And that process, Ben observing that, that's the thing he's after, because Ben is really like thinking about it on this deep level. And I think the reason that John O'Brien is like giving Ben's character such depth is he's kind of writing his own story. You know, he drank himself to death. He ended up completing suicide with a firearm, but he had been killing himself with alcohol for years beyond that. He actually found out that this was going to be made into a major motion picture, I think 2 weeks before he ended up dying. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I think in a lot of ways, this was a world John O'Brien was familiar with himself.
Your assessment of like how you read him watching the stripper and like turning herself on, it reminded me initially just of like him, when he was in line at the bank or whatever with his recorder, and he's just doing that kind of narration for the teller or something like that. I'm wondering if that was that bank scene in the book or.
It's really, I'm glad you brought that up. It's really good that you noted that, because yeah, that was also a really interesting move on Mike Figgis's part. So in the film, Ben is standing. So he goes to the bank. He can't sign his check because he's too sober and he's shaking so hard.
DTs.
Yeah. Yeah. So he leaves, he gets sauced, and then he comes back. So the second time he's waiting in line and he pulls out a little pocket recorder and he says this thing about you would be so much more interesting and desirable if you were covered in bourbon. And then it gets more and more illicit. In the film, that's all happening in the bank and he's speaking it into his recorder. But in the book, he goes and he signs the check. Then he goes to a bar and that's all happens in his head. He doesn't do that as like a public shameful act. It's like, again, Ben is like a more thoughtful. He's less belligerent in the book. Mm. In the film, like I don't know if that was Cage's decision or if that was it seems like it was Mike Figgis's decision to make Ben a little more sloppy, belligerent and less like kind of a thoughtful, like artistic drunk, you know, if that makes sense.
I feel like he is and he isn't in the film. We don't have the luxury of having a narrator of his mind. So we do see a really charming version of him, like when he has a certain amount to drink and then he has too much to drink. And so we see like those transitions and how far it goes and how dangerous it really gets all throughout the film.
And Sarah makes note of it at 1.2, where I can't remember the exact line, but she comes out and says like, you know, sometimes you open your mouth and like gold falls out. Yeah, like, basically yeah. Like you do have some eloquence, some yeah. ability to talk
totally
without being a fucking, I don't know, pap smear or something.
And then later when she says she wants him to see a doctor and he responds with, oh, no, see doctor. Sarah.
One thing that I was curious about, because the only piece of this that I really don't give a shit about is the whole Yuri subplot. Is that in the book?
Okay, yeah. So this is interesting too. So in the book, his name is Amal Fati. And I gather that he's supposed to be Middle Eastern. And in the film, he's turned into a Latvian named Yuri. And in the book, you get a pretty significant piece of Sarah's backstory is wrapped up into her relationship with this guy. And they used to work together in Los Angeles. They used to be romantically entangled. His character has a lot more depth to it. I don't know why they tried to squeeze it in. They lost a lot of the complexity of it, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah, this is like, you know, if you had some sort of master cut that was 3 hours long, I'm sure there's more that could be plumbed from that. And it just doesn't play, in my mind at least, for anything that has value in that. Because he's like a guy, he's in charge of her, and then he dies, and that's it.
He doesn't have a very strong presence in the film. And for a film that's, you know, just under 2 hours, he could probably, he's a very dismissible, like 10 minutes of it maybe. And it wouldn't be that hard to write around the absence of the character.
I think the strength of having that character is it shows how little control she had over her relationships in her life. And then she immediately kind of jumps in this whole thing with Ben, which she has no control over, but because he's nice to her, she tries to.
It serves the point of the restructuring of her story in the movie, because it's not until Yuri's gone that her relationship with John's takes a more dangerous edge, to the point where, like, when she does have the gang rape scene, she's gone from being like $300 to get in the door, 500 before anything happens, to $200 for an hour in a room full of three kind of like frat guys. And it really spirals out of hand because she doesn't have any protections now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously not advocating for pimps, but I mean, somebody's got to have a strong hand in the relationship, right?
So Rox, I'm kind of curious about this. Like, did you read the book?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So you saw the movie and then Gary read the book. And then how did it change your experience from watching it another time after talking to him and experiencing him knowing more about it?
Well, to be fair, I didn't rewatch it today with Rob, actually. I did do some research on Sheryl Crow.
Tell me more. Yeah.
So if you like me,
I do like you. It's been really nice.
You're great.
Thanks,
come
guys.
Back again.
Yeah.
That really means a lot to me and all of the Rappaports out there.
No, Michael can't come on. Sorry.
Aww. Yeah, talk about Cheryl C.
It's that cat that looks like grandma.
That fucking weird looking cat again. You guys ever seen a cat with a human face?
Terrifying.
I have. It's a weird.
Yeah, it's like Renaissance paintings.
Yeah.
Sorry, please continue.
Well, okay, so when Rob let me know that we were invited to do this podcast with you guys back in last year, I guess, the first thing I said was, is Leaving Las Vegas about the Sheryl Crow song?
Oh, yes.
Like, does it mean that I'm going to get to watch or listen to the Sheryl Crow song was my first question. And we laughed it off, and I interpreted that to mean that no, the two have nothing to do with each other. But in fact, I did some research today, and there is a connection. Sheryl Crow wrote her debut album, Tuesday Night Music Club, which if you haven't given it a listen now or in a while, it's pretty great. It's very listenable. It's got some really good stuff on there. She debuted that album in 1994 and appeared on David Letterman's show 3 weeks before John O'Brien completed suicide with the song Leaving Las Vegas. And the song was written by her and another guy who was a part of a group of musicians in L.A. that called themselves the Tuesday Night Music Club. The guy that she wrote the song with was actually supposedly a friend or acquaintance of John O'Brien. And he kind of borrowed from the, not really the story, but more like the imagery of the book in his contributions to that song.
Mm-hmm. And just to interject, I think that goes to show that there's just such a tragedy here in the story of John O'Brien. I think he was really, really talented and was starting to make inroads in Hollywood, starting to meet people, starting to get in, and could have maybe had a break, you know, beyond just this novel and the Rugrats episode.
Like, which we will get to.
Well, yeah, there was more. Unfortunately, there was so much more we could have gotten from this man.
Yeah.
So David Bearwald was the guy's name who co-wrote Leaving Las Vegas with Sheryl Crow. And I guess there was kind of a moment that happened after. So Sheryl Crow was on David Letterman. She was interviewed about the song and asked if it was autobiographical. And she gave kind of a mixed answer where she said, like, kind of, I have nothing to do with Las Vegas. I was sort of writing it about L.A. And I guess there was at the time after John O'Brien's death, there was some outcry. People like rewatched that interview and said, oh, he decided to kill himself because Sheryl Crow didn't give him credit. He was really pissed off about it. And I guess there was some truth to that. He was very upset, but it seems pretty clear. And his sister has made a statement. John O'Brien's sister made a statement about how there's not a direct causal link between Sheryl Crow and her brother's death. Also, this guy, David Bearwald, he kind of sounds like an ass. He kind of threw Sheryl Crow under the bus for that. Even though he's the one who wrote the title of the song. And yeah, it was just really interesting to me because I kind of popped in on Rob watching the film again today and just thinking about this connection of like the LA, everything the LA scene represents, which not that I know anything about that personally, mostly just through watching Selling Sunset on Netflix. but yeah, just this like, I get the sense that John O'Brien had a really ambivalent relationship with success. Like, he was clearly a really driven artist. Like, he had a lot in him. He wanted to create and get out into the world. And it seems like there's several stories that kind of show the way that he was like really upset when things didn't go as he would have wanted in his creative vision. It was really like, he took it very personally.
Well, like his one credit, is an episode of Rugrats, Toys in the Attic, which from what I read on the internet was kind of a gimme job given to him by his sister.
Mm.
From what I understand, he was really upset with some of the changes they made to the script.
Yeah.
For which ultimately was an 8-minute episode about Tommy Pickles and Angelica spending the weekend at Tommy's grandparents' house and going into the attic to find some toys.
Goes deeper than that, man.
Like Nazi memorabilia.
Angelica convinces Tommy that there's a ghost in the attic, so he doesn't want to go, but she knows there's toys up there, and she's like, I'm the one who told you there were ghosts, dummy. And then the grandpa comes, and like a window opens and a sheet blows over the grandpa, so they think he's a ghost, but there's no substance to it. It's Rugrats.
I would be, yeah, I mean, I cannot imagine getting too upset about my writing getting fucked up for a kid's show.
But if it's all you have in
that kid's show.
I mean, so you were saying how, you know, we could have probably got a lot more work from this guy if he survived. And I don't know that we would have, at least in any large scale professional sense, because especially when you're working within a studio system, you can't be that precious with your own work. And to continue to get work, you need, the way we talked about in art school, is you need two of three things. You need to be the best, easy to work with, or always on time. You could be easy to work with and always on time, you'll always have a job. You could be the best and an asshole, but you always show up, you'll always have a job.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think he would have been absolutely furious with some of the choices that Mike Figgis made with Leaving Las Vegas. If he was upset about Rugrats, and I read a quote that his sister Erin said she thought the changes to his writing were totally justified. Like completely made sense because it's a kid's show.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tommy Pickles can't die at the end. Sorry, dude.
I kind of want to tie a bow on the Sheryl Crow thing for a minute. What I found myself thinking about was the sort of the way that as Sheryl Crow's star was rising, John O'Brien's was setting, and just the sort of what were the qualities that like sort of would set two people like this apart, these two paths that kind of crossed and then passed each other in this weird way. I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to like, I don't know a core reason why, but I think it's interesting to look at the way that, I don't know. It feels like inappropriate in some ways to abstract this because John O'Brien, at the end of the day, was just, he was a human being and he died in a really traumatic way. And Sheryl Crow, also a human being doing her thing. But if we can kind of like look at them as these two sort of archetypes or kind of see them as something larger than themselves, I think I see John O'Brien as a person who, yeah, like clearly his whole life, it seems like, was just really, really, really in struggle. Like never was a person who really was not at peace for his whole life. And like just internalized so much and was just wrestling with so much all the time, and created clearly some really powerful art out of that place. Sheryl Crow, a person who, I mean, she got her start as a backup singer for Michael Jackson and endured in that setting. Like, I watched an interview with her today where she talked about sexual abuse, or sexual harassment that she experienced in, you know, in that kind of life, and clearly had, like, she was a person who was able to deal with some pretty shitty life stuff and like find a way through it. Like, she, yeah, this is why trauma is trauma. It's a perceptual experience. It's like, what, it's not the event itself. It's what people make of it, you know? And I think that, I'm not trying to compare their like backstories at all, but just more this idea of like, yeah, that some people are cut out for this LA lifestyle thing and other people seem like they are going to struggle a lot more. And it's really sad.
Good though. I had heard some of the Sheryl Crow stuff before, but I didn't get super deep into it. It's interesting to hear. It's so crazy that this can be a book, a movie, and influence a song. Mm. Like, that doesn't happen too often. It's almost EGOTing itself.
Yeah.
So it just needs a Tony Award winning play.
Right.
Where Nicolas Cage, played by, Daniel Radcliffe.
Ooh.
Ooh, that's good, actually.
Would just drink himself to death with a naked horse.
Yeah. And I think it would translate to this stage in that way, because the dynamic between Ben and Sarah is so juicy. Like,
oh, and it's rife with good soliloquies and monologues.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
What would the big toe-tapping single going for Tony, so it's a musical.
Yeah, it's gotta be. Ooh. Ooh,
no, the hook is definitely like the shopping for all the booze.
Ooh, yeah,
yeah. It's a see my vest kind of a situation. Yeah.
Oh my god, no! It's they still use that fucking Sting song.
Oh yeah.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking the funniest thing that I remember from that episode that we lost is that we were talking so much about like Sting
and then I don't remember anything
else other than that.
Well, I said it's really a shame that Sting and the Edge have the names they have, because they should switch.
Definitely switch. Maybe they will eventually, but they're keeping us hanging.
They're edging us on.
Mm.
It's a beautiful film. It still holds up great. The performances are awesome. Mm. I still think it's weird how the movie ends with like the sitcom style credits where you just see Ben like smiling at the camera.
Yeah, the last minute or so after, like, first I was like, oh my god, she gives killer hand jobs, and then I was like, oh wait, no, that joke doesn't work because she fucks him. Sad. And then like I'm like, okay, well, he died having sex and that's pretty cool. And then he wasn't dead, and it was a weird roller coaster for me, just edging. Reliving this. Yeah. And then finally the credits roll, and like I listened to that Sting song one more time, and
then you came.
You do a great Sting impression. I never knew you had one in the tank there.
Right in the chamber. Yeah. Ready to roll.
Oh, Sting. Always one in the chamber. Forever one in the chamber.
All right, we got back to where I wanted to be.
I agree. I think it's a incredible movie. And like Nicolas Cage's transformation, just even throughout the movie, like ups and downs. The physicality of his drunkenness is so incredible. Like, I never look at the film and think like that's somebody acting drunk, pretending to be drunk, or putting on a show. This is like, that's a drunk dude. He's drunk in some level. And I mean, it's both like upsetting to watch in like the hardest moments. It's entertaining.
I think one of the reasons this movie works as well as it does is because of his performance and how much you genuinely tend to like Ben, despite what he's doing is horrible. You hope that somehow by the end he'll be brought out of it by Sarah or something. Like, you want that for him, even though you know it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I know. I want to stand up for him and be like, well, he's not hurting anybody else, but like, obviously, yes, he hurts Sarah a lot throughout the film. But ultimately, like, he was doing this before she was there too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, something that's coming up for me right now is thinking about the way that I think Sarah represents for me John O'Brien's attempt to question his own motives in, because I think what John O'Brien did was like kind of a slow motion suicide. And then he finally like decided he was just going to end the whole thing with a gun rather than continuing to do alcohol. But Sarah represents this like will to live in spite of it, because you might look at Sarah and be like, well, what does she have to live for? She's got this shitbag pimp that beats her and cuts her. She hangs out in Las Vegas. She gets raped by these piece of shit teenager football players. She even falls in love with a guy who has no will to live. Like, what does, why does Sarah want to continue going on? And I think she represents a character that shows resilience in spite of her circumstances. Whereas you look at a guy like Ben, he's got everything. He's got a fancy life in LA. He's got a wife and a kid. He's got a successful career, and he just pisses it all away. And it just doesn't make sense. And I think John O'Brien, with the interplay between these two characters, is trying to ask the question, maybe to your point, Rox, about Sheryl Crow and John O'Brien. Well, what allows some people to thrive in spite of the shit that they find themselves in, where other people fall into states of depression and addiction and suicidality? In a way, Ben is the more likable character. There is something about him that you like, you're really rooting for him, where I found myself relating to Sarah with a lot of ambivalence. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't really feel like I was rooting for her to get her life together. Like, what is she even about? Like, there's nothing very deliberate about her. Like, what is she trying to do with her life? And in her therapy sessions, those cutaway scenes in therapy, those are some of the more revealing passages from the film. All she's doing is like talking about Ben, talking about her relationship with Ben. Like, yeah. Where is Sarah? What is driving Sarah on? What is the thing that is, why does she want to live? What's continuing to drive her on? So anyhow, all of those questions land really strongly in the book. And I do think they were adapted to film well enough by Mike Figgis and his team that it, yeah, very profound film. Super glad to have watched it and read this book.
Well, to that last point that you just made, Rob, I think something that does stand out to me is that, and I just, yeah, as a, just to be clear about where I'm coming from when I say this, is as a person who definitely tends towards, oh, like hyper-focusing on my own internal experience to the point that I know that I can get lost and lose out on remembering that other people are actually having their own lives and their own experiences and thoughts. And I think that's kind of core to the experience of depression and of suicidality, is this inability to think beyond that. It's this tunnel vision that gets created. So I think that if there's a question around like what is going on for Sarah, then I see that as in a way of representative of that, the mind frame of a character like Ben, or of perhaps a person like John O'Brien, when you're in the real depths of that kind of experience of pain. To get nerdy for a second, something that I thought a lot about while watching the movie and while talking to you, Rob, about John O'Brien and the book, was kind of thinking about this through the lens of a model that's like used a lot in addiction, like substance use treatment in terms of in counseling and social work, which is this stages of change model. It's the idea that they're kind of identifying like five stages that people tend to go through, and they're not linear. It's like you kind of loop back around a lot of times or go back and forth between multiple, from pre-contemplation to contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance. And I feel like where this film really lives, and the book too, presumably, is in the contemplation phase, which is defined by ambivalence. It's this sense of like, okay, I'm conscious that there's something in my life that's not working, and I can see how things could be different, but I also don't want them to be different because change is scary and it's too much. And I think that I think that to create a work like this represents on some level, like a will to live. Like, you don't make things unless you are still of the world, you know, unless you believe that things are worthy of being made. And I see that in Ben's relationship with Sarah, that there is a part of him that wants this, that wants to be loved, that wants this connection. And then there's also a part of him that is very settled in this plan that's not going to happen. And so, yeah, I think that's why this is so tragic, is like that it really put, yeah, as the viewer, the reader, you're really kind of like in the depths of that ambivalence, which is just so painful. And to see the way that can go the direction of, like, you don't get to the next stage. That is where it ends for some people. Yeah, to tie in Sheryl Crow one last time, I think it puts a really intense... It made me think about, I was reading lyrics to the song Leaving Las Vegas, which, like I said, I think we're really kind of inspired more by the vibes of Las Vegas than the story itself.
Have you ever watched the music video?
No, I haven't. How would you describe it?
If I remember correctly, it's a lot of like her playing a guitar in the desert and shots of like the entering Las Vegas sign and things like that. It wasn't much to speak of. It's just kind of like a weird music video for the whole subject.
It's really interesting. It's dawning on me now how interesting it is that Las Vegas is the backdrop for this, given what you're saying, Roxanne, about the fact that Ben and Sarah both, it's like they both struggle from a lot of entropy, where like they're having a really hard time making any changes for the good, where that's like the whole draw of Las Vegas. You go there so you can like get rich quick. You can make a big positive change for your life quickly and really
that's
make
the hope. Yeah,
right. Make the something dream happen for yourself. Or even if you don't get rich, you like have a huge like pleasurable experience. You go and indulge. Like it's a place of immediacy. Whereas what you're pointing out is we meet two characters struggling to move beyond like their stability.
Yeah, this idea that there are kind of two ways to leave Las Vegas. You're either Sheryl Crow and you know you're this story of you're leaving in the sense that you are putting it behind you, or you're leaving in the John O'Brien sense. You know, that's your final act,
your exit stage left.
Totally. And the line that I keep coming back to in the song is such a muddy line between the things you want and the things you have to do. And, you know, I if you read that through an addiction lens, I think that, yeah, it's really powerful to think about the drive for pleasure, for escape, which is really like essential, I think, and healthy. And then, yeah, where is the line between when that becomes something that is this self-destructive cycle to a really tragic end?
Still a great film. Again, a hard film, but a great, powerful film and an amazing performance by Nick Cage. There's a reason he has an Oscar because of this.
Yeah, very, very much deserving of the praise that he got.
Yeah, nothing but love for this all the way around.
Good movie, good Cage, great orange shirt.
It's true.
Yes. Is it orange or is it like salmon? It struck me as salmon.
It's very orange in that picture, which I'm very familiar with because
I see what you're saying. No, I think that's more of a salmon.
Yeah.
Give us a dick joke, Nick. Let's bring the party back up.
Oh, bring it up.
Oh, dick jokes on command. God, this is hard.
Give us another dick acronym.
You know, I'll come up with something and we'll just edit it.
Yeah, put it in post.
Yeah.
Okay, so what movie goes forward? Obviously, we already decided this, but let's just put it officially.
Absolutely. Leaving Las Vegas, man. This is... boy, I look forward to the day when we watch a movie that I can just say is more deserving of going on than this in a head-to-head.
What are you guys doing with new Cage movies that are coming out?
We watch them. We talk yeah. about them. I think at some point we'll discuss.
We're more enthusiastic about it than Sean makes it sound. We go there. We go yeah. to the theater. We see yeah. the films, and we put out an episode. We try to do it within a week. Yeah. Or within the week of it opening.
I think eventually I want to do a thing where we kind of discuss the movies that have come out or didn't make the bracket and be like, oh, where do we think this could have fit in?
Yeah, where would it fit in just
the ghost
general,
bracket?
Yeah. Watching all the movies that yeah. he's been in. You know, there's so many movies like that just have Nick Cage.
We'll just
that
are, do some mescaline in a tent yeah. and talk about Nicolas Cage. Like what could have been, man?
It's like what deserved a role?
You guys, you could be 200 hours yeah. of audio to edit.
Yeah. Pass me that wooden duck.
I was
but the
thinking
dumb
about...
thing is none of it got recorded because we were fucking high. God, again.
I was just thinking about how much time you guys have spent on this podcast so far, and for there still to be a matchup this poorly weighted, like it's so clearly
this
leaving,
is only the
like,
second round.
Yeah, how are you
round two? Man.
Like, when is it going to get interesting? Like, this is clearly like an overmatch, right?
I'm sorry, you don't like our podcast.
No, I'm applauding you. I'm saying you guys are going so slow and taking your time and really getting into the material that even this far in,
what
you if, still have a matchup like this.
What did Kiss of Death go up against first?
Oh, God. It's something it twice would, as it bad. It was probably like City of Angels or yeah. some shit.
Yeah, you guys hated that. Yeah.
City of Angels was a terrible movie. That can get fucked. Yeah,
I told you my ex-wife loved it. We talked about that in the last episode.
Oh, man.
Your ex-wife is wrong.
That might be the reason your laptop got stolen, because that marriage was doomed, and then it just somehow transferred its doom energy onto your laptop. I'm sorry.
Okay. So
I owe you money.
Leaving Las Vegas goes up against Joe next time.
Ooh.
Good matchup. That's a good conversation.
Oh, that's a depressing weekend.
It's a very depressing weekend.
I don't. I need more alcohol.
What was the other question? Why did I bring this up?
What did Kiss of Death go up against?
Yeah, how did it make it to the
City of Angels?
Yeah.
Okay.
City of Angels is dog shit.
Yeah. It's so bad.
Yeah, this is one that just squeaked by because the competition was so poor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was bound to happen.
It's the challenge of this fucking concept that we have. It's like, it takes forever and there's so many bad movies in the mix and we're whittling it down. And the Slicksteen is way better than the Round of 32.
Wicker Man's still going strong.
Yeah, baby, as it should be.
So is Army of One.
As it should be.
I've come around on that one.
I fucking love Army of One, so, man.
I'm amazed you guys didn't blow my fucking levels on that.
Well, I did Chocolate Rain away from the mic.
Yeah,
so,
that's true. Thank you. I appreciate that. Breathe away.
Yeah.
Can I make a suggestion for a thing you guys can do for your Patreon to make some money?
Yes.
We love making money. Well, we love the concept. We haven't tried it yet.
I have not been able to stop thinking about the moment in Between Worlds where Nick Cage reads out loud from the memoirs.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
The Inuit clapped.
Inuit clapped.
What would you think about, like, you know,
writing our own Cage erotica?
Yes. And then like shooting videos of yourselves reading it in like the same style where you're breaking the fourth wall.
If you guys write us that poetry, we will read it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, let's lay it on the line. Write us your Nick Cage poetry. I'll buy a smoking jacket and we'll find a fireplace.
Perfect. Yeah. We can make this happen.
Yeah. We'll rotate who wears, who reads.
Yeah.
It's good.
I like this idea.
Only for the patrons. Sign up for our Patreon. Thank you to our Sparkle Buddies, Josh, Sean, Josie, Rico, Matt, Adam, and Bill. And our Cage Dancers, Ira, John, Freeman, Lance, and Nathan. But thank you guys for being here.
What's that thing you just did?
What a pleasure.
A segue.
Is that what a segue is?
Hey, let's go home. I'm tired and have a new baby.
Aww.
Do you guys have anything you want to promote or just put out there?
Well, I would highly recommend people read the book. It's a super easy read. You can make it through and in a weekend. It's 189 pages and it's rather profound. I think John O'Brien is kind of a lost treasure of U.S. American literature. So, yeah, I'll just plug the book.
Nice.
And I'll plug Asking for Help, getting help if you need it.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
I'm going to close on Wang. willing and not gangrenous.
Wow.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
It's been a minute since I've said that.
Yeah, it's true. You're right.
It's not an audience time.
No, not they don't know time. Shit.
As far as they know, we just watched The Croods 2, which was great.
The recruiting.
Sorry, I just wanted to make like a louder, cruder beer joke.
Oh, yeah, nice. Bigger, cruder.
Crudier.
Yeah.
Crudité.
No. It was what?
It was a 6-hour class.
Dang.
That's why you need the staff. You can fall asleep.
I guess. Man.
It was a painting.
You get your rest.
It was a painting class, and the long pose was seated, so it really wasn't that bad.
The long pose? Well, really being generous with yourself there.
All right, that was pretty good. I'll put it up.
All right.